Let me start the revenue session, and there are three topics: licenses, collectivity, and constraint. The first topic is licensing. In this paper, SBJ staff are trying to differentiate various kinds of license arrangements in terms of the possible other promises included in a licensing arrangement. We noted that paragraph B37 of the 2011 ED proposed that promise to maintain and defend patent right is not a performance obligation, but is an action by the entity to protect the value of the entity's intellectual property assets. Some SBJ staff questioned that in other situations, such as brand name in the retail and consumer industry, are there any other implied performance obligation in the arrangement? There are three alternative views. View A, an implied performance obligation exists for both patent and brand. Based on this view, a license would always include some sort of implied performance obligation to provide additional service to the customer, and that performance obligation is not distinct, and therefore, license generally is a performance obligation satisfied over time. This is written in paragraph 12 of our paper. And we have view B, an implied performance obligation may exist in certain cases. That means no performance obligation for a patent, but that could be a performance obligation for a brand. Under view B, there are two aspects of an entity's activities. The first one is activities by the entity to protect the intellectual property from being used illegally, and the second aspect is more proactive activities by the entity to enhance the value of the intellectual property or extend the economic useful life of the asset, or both. If a nature of a particular license has characteristics described in the second aspect, then the entity's activities could be an additional performance obligation implied in the licensing arrangement. This is view B. And view C, there are no implied performance obligation exist for both patent and brands. Under view C, protection against patent infringement, as well as other activities by an entity to maintain the value of the entity's intellectual property, does not transfer any goods or services to a customer, and therefore, they do not represent performance obligations. So, there are three alternative views, and there are mixed views among SBJ members and the staff. Some support view A, and others support view B, and we'd like to discuss your views on this matter.
Thank you. Thank you for these views. I think they capture quite a bit of the discussions we've had sort of amongst ourselves as well. Since July, we've had a lot of internal discussions with ourselves and with board members as well. And I think that various aspects of this are starting to come through in some of the alternatives we're considering. I think your view B is probably something that's quite close to an alternative that we've discussed with some board members in small group meetings. Some of the comments that we've received is that some of these activities that you highlight in paragraph 16, number 2, that are activities to enhance the value of the intellectual property and extend the useful life of the asset. I think some people have some sympathy for that, but there are some people who are a bit nervous that does may not necessarily always transfer value or transfer goods and services to the customer. So I think that's helpful. I'm not sure where the boards will go, but I think a number of people see that view as well. I think with View A, I think some board members would like the result of View A, but some get there a little bit differently than with the analysis that you have here, with the implied performance obligations or implied promises. I think some board members view a license as access to the intellectual property. So the entity is providing access to its intellectual property, and that's why a license should be, the revenue should be recognized over time. And that was some of the views that we expressed in our basis for conclusions in paragraph 315B. And I think some board members are using that to support some of their views. I think view C is probably closest to the 2011 ED. Although I think we sort of took a slightly different approach, but certainly the result is fairly similar. One of the things that we've realized is that understanding what a license is influences many of the thinking thoughts that you have here, but also influences how that performance obligation is satisfied. So if you view the license as a right to use the intellectual property, that will likely result in a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time and might be closest to your view C. But if you view the license as a promise to provide access, that may suggest that there might be something else that the entity has to do, and that'll be closest to your view A. So I think that we've spent a great deal of time thinking about this, and I was really interested to see your paper, because I think some of those elements are some of the things that we've been debating as well.
So we'll settle for a view B, a nice intermediate solution to this theological problem.
Only with that simple.
Huh?
It
sounds very plausible to me. But indeed, if you sell a patent, what performance obligation do you still have to fulfill?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, it's like I just said in the leasing discussion, just people have a different view about what are the economics of a lease, what's being transferred. It's the same with a license. And I guess, you know, sub-board members basically do think that unless you've really sold something, what you're really granting, as Alison said, is just access to your IP, and therefore, you know, you're providing basically a service. And so, to give you a very simple example, you know, they would see a distinction between selling a perpetual right to use some software versus giving the customer a one-year license to that software, because they would sort of say in the one you've effectively sold the software program to the customer. They control that software program. And in the case of when it's a one-year license, effectively you haven't given them the full economic benefits or the full potential economic benefits from that software program. So they would say what you've given the customer is a right to use that program, and therefore you'd recognize revenue over the license period. Whereas I think many other board members would just look at it and say, in that simple example, you've just transferred a right to the customer in both cases. It's just that the rights have different attributes. But once you've transferred the right to the customer, you finish, you're fully performed, and therefore it's appropriate to recognize the revenue. So that's quite a big difference of thinking there, but that's what we, the staff team, are challenged with, of trying to sort of coalesce these views.
Equal.
I think this and the license issues seem to be similar, but this handles tangible asset. So if the lessor controls the asset, lessee doesn't. And if the lessee controls the asset, lessor doesn't. But in case of intangible asset, there are two characteristics. Intangible assets could be divided as you like,
absolutely,
but they are not completely separated.
Yeah.
There is a root or fundamental rights,
yeah,
and the fundamental rights and the individual separated right,
yeah,
are connected.
That's right.
If the root is not worthless, it becomes worthless, the portion given to the licensee is also worthless. So licensor always perform the services for themselves to protect their right, but that service also the service for the licensee. Mm-hmm. So that means licensing is a series of, in most cases, series of services for the license period. I think so. I strongly support BUA.
Would you see a distinction between something like a brand and software? The reason why I ask is because I agree with what you said there about why you know licenses are different from leases, in the sense you can carve up an intangible asset many ways. But if I grant TAC a right to use a brand, my brand, for 5 years, versus I grant Allison a piece of software to use for 5 years, and I'm not going to support that software. But clearly with the brand, I will continue to maintain and manage the overall brand, and TAC will in some degree always have the benefit of the brand as it now is, whether that be for the better or for the worse, hopefully for the better. So do you see that there could be a difference? Because I can see how a lot of people would say, look, with a brand, you are always providing sort of access to your intangible and therefore revenue over time, versus maybe, I provide some software or some proprietary know-how, like a compound or something like that, albeit even still for a period of time, but that would say, well, the revenue should be once you've made it available. Might be able to see a distinction between those two examples.
So you mean software like what kind of software do you
program?
A program, or
you sell it for, yeah, 1 year, or let's say for 5 years, and you said yes, it has the, it could become worthless.
Hmm.
Then definitely you've done a good sale.
Hmm.
Because sold it for 5 years. After 1 year, a fantastic alternative comes on the market, which is 10 times better than the one that you sold to Allison. Seems to me that then you've really made a sale. And it would be right to recognize in time. Whereas with a brand, the presumption will always be that you continue investing in the brand, because brand needs continuous investment. I suppose that in most contracts there would be stipulations about that too.
Yeah.
And then you have more of a service agreement than a sale.
I think it's something related to the exclusiveness. If the software, the function is the important thing. It doesn't have to be exclusive, and it is useful even if others could use. So that is a kind of product, a simple product. So it could be a sales I didn't know you said you're eager. Could be one-time sales. So if you've got some kind of software.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly one of the lines we've been exploring is sort of trying to find is a way of cutting it so that you say, you know, simply some licenses are much more in the nature of providing the customer with a product, mm-hmm. which they have to take control of, versus those which are much more akin to a service. And so we've been sort of exploring some ideas. But as I said, there are some board members who would feel that even providing, you know, basically shrink wrap software, but providing software on a completed product, which you're not going to provide any additional services on, and you just give the customer 1 year right to use that software, they would still see that as being a service rather than being a sale of a software product. So, you know, there are just very different views.
I think the difficulty, the nub of the difficulty is that licenses take many different forms. Henry was trying to demonstrate two very common ones that we're trying to distinguish. But there are many things that are licenses, but they have different properties. And so I think what you've laid out is very helpful to think about ways to distinguish. But we're also trying to explore whether there's more things that we can help try to distinguish what are the differences in licenses and how that translates into the different performance obligations related to a license.
Yes, based on my experience as a younger auditor, you know, back to many, many years ago, I'm not younger anymore, but I was auditors, you know, back to many years ago. I was assigned to a royalty audit of the Japanese licensee to make a, you know, necktie with a very famous brand. And then, you know, licensor is in UK, London. So when I visited the company for audit, I made a question the president, how you are sure this brand will be valuable for license period, say next 5 years or 10 years. Then I asked him, please show a contract with the licensor. And even I check, you know, contract, there's no specific clause. Licensor is obligable to do something in order to maintain value of that, you know, brand. So I pointed out, you see this has nothing to do. Why you invest such huge amount of money into this, you know, brand businesses? But he said, without writing anything specifically, it is customs in this industry. Licensor should do that, work or advertisement or many effort in order to maintain that value of brand. Otherwise, that the licensee wouldn't invest, you know, such huge amount of money. So based on this, example, I think there would be implied performance obligations for the licensor, regardless of written in the agreement. But depends on, contract or depends on the relationship between licensee and the licensor. So it may be difficult. We say always there is implied performance obligation. So that the view A may be somehow squeezed out from my, experience. And view C is also, this is denying such existence. So based on my experience, view B might be more practical and reasonable solution, even based on my experience, I guess, This is just my personal,
I think this is a nice example. It would be, obviously in terms of this necktie manufacturer. It's a very asymmetrical relationship with the supplier of the bread, which is probably a very big firm. And it's not very likely that he will accept a contract in which the necktie manufacturer has all kinds of stipulations about what he has to do to maintain the bread. But it's not very likely that is understood. And that's why I think probably this implied notion is reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, back to the revenue standard. So do we really need to stick to the license as a special or exceptional object? It should just follow the regular way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So if it's service, it's recognized over time. So it's not an exception.
I agree, and I think that's our thinking as well. I think when I was talking about whether the license represents a right or access, I think that's where we would like to help people, because I think if you think of it as a right, it is very hard to think about it as a service at the same time. So I think we're going to try to help people with the starting point, or what is the nature of the promise, and then the rest of the revenue model would apply. So paragraphs 35, the performance obligation satisfied over time, or paragraph 37, satisfied at a point in time, an entity would still think about those paragraphs, as well as the separation, the identification of the separate performance obligations as well.
To determine whether it's a right or access. I would think it's more important to establish whether there is an implied or explicit performance obligation still to be fulfilled.
I think that's part of it, though. I think we're really trying to help people what it is that the entity has promised to do. And with the necktie example, what has that entity really promised to do? The implied performance obligations is really part of it. And maybe I'm using access is too much shorthand, but I think we're just trying to help people understand what it is that license represents.
I think you've got to give people that starting point. Mm-hmm. And the nub of the difficulty that we have is that the 2011 ED said conceptually it is a right you're transferring. Now, when you apply other parts of the model, you could easily end up in a situation whereby you recognize revenue over time, because that right gets bundled up with services and you just account for it as a single service. But I think it's that assertion in the basis for conclusion that paragraph BC315, which says, you know, it's a right that some board members disagree with, and they think that effectively that actually licenses vary and their nature varies, and in some cases it is, as I said, it's like a right that you transfer a point in time, and in other cases, even if there's nothing else in the contract, it's more akin to providing access, and they want to make that distinction in the standard mm-hmm. before you apply the rest of the model.
Okay. Oh, sorry. So you have, Ikuo and Atsu, you have bitter fights about this?
Not fighting.
A and UB.
We're balanced, you know. We should be balanced.
Cannot sit next to each other tonight.
Okay, thank you, Henry and Alison. Let's move on to topic two. It's a collectibility. And there are four issues, but before I get into each issue, let me explain our overall position on collectivity. First, we believe that only in situations where customers' higher credit risk is reflected in the transaction price are suitable for impairment losses being presented in relation to revenue. By presenting impairment losses in relation to revenue, users could better understand the entity's business. That is the reason. However, we believe that these situations doing business in a higher customer's credit risk are very rare in practice, maybe in our jurisdiction. Second, we believe that the revenue should reflect the amount that an entity is expected to be entitled to receive, rather than the amount the entity is expected to receive. So, given these premises, let me summarize our view on each war issue. Issue one, the recognition threshold for collectibility. SBJ staff disagree with the introduction of revenue recognition threshold for collectibility because an entity's performance or customer's control and the collectibility are different notions, as we explained in our paper, paragraph 26. The issue two, is an adjacent presentation necessary? As we mentioned earlier, SBJ staff believe that an adjacent presentation is only useful for situations where an entity's business is exposed to a customer's higher credit risk, and the risk is incorporated into the transaction price as a risk premium. So, for all others, we think the adjacent presentation does not provide better information to the users of the financial statements. Issue three, presentation of impairment losses arising from transaction with a significant financing component. SBJ staff believe that regardless of the significant financing component included in the contract with customers, impairment losses should be presented in a consistent manner, either adjacent to the revenue in the case of high-risk businesses or as other operating expenses in the case of all other business or transactions. That is issue three. And finally, issue four, what is revenue from contract with customers, either a top-line amount or a net of impairment losses? We believe that a top line should be the revenue equal to the amount of consideration to which the entity expects to be entitled in exchange for satisfying each separate performance obligation. The top line amount depicts the entity's performance to the customer during the reporting period. An impairment loss is important information to users, but it is not an entity's performance to the customer, but a separate activity by the entity. Therefore, we recommend that the revenue standard should clarify the impairment losses are not part of revenue. These are our views on collectibility, and now we'd like to hear your views.
Who?
Yeah, I can go. I think, you know, the very difficult thing about collectibility is I think there are two different views. The question of the threshold, I think some board members would still like to see the threshold. But like you, I think we met with a user group last week who didn't favor a threshold either. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the adjacent presentation, the user group we met with last week also didn't favor adjacent presentation. But they didn't necessarily favor it with high credit risk customers either. They were happy to see the presentation with other expenses as long as it was clearly identified. I liked some of the ideas that you had in here about assessing the revenue, the sales transactions, and the credit transactions separately, and those users very much thought that that was important as well. And they thought that as long as it was shown separately, then that was fine. The one thing that I thought was interesting was the presentation of impairment losses related to contracts with a significant financing component as being consistent with the other. the other transactions as well. I think that a few others share that concern as well, but I think some people still look at those significant financing components as being quite separate from a straightforward contract with a customer. And some of that's because the impairment loss would be built into the rate, the implicit rate in that contract as well. So the transaction price would really be the cash price in that circumstance. In terms of your last issue about what is revenue, I think most people who don't support the adjacent presentation agree with this circumstance as well. In terms of our paper, we are developing a paper for November, but I'm not sure where we'll end up in terms of the staff recommendation on all these issues, because it's very difficult to balance, I think, the different views on each one of them.
Yeah, this is a very helpful and timely piece of analysis that you've done, because, as you know, we had a board discussion on this one in September, and we've had various discussions with various people since, various users, and we're coming back in November. I think that, you know, everybody wants to try and get everything as consistent as possible with various bits and pieces. So on the one hand, we'd like the impairments on those revenue transactions that result in a loan. We'd like the impairments on the loan component to be treated as they would if it was just a sort of a standalone originated loan without the sale of a product. I think what I've heard most of all is that why people don't like the adjacent to revenue line that we had in the exposure draft was the day two impairments. I think people really struggle with those day two impairments being in that line adjacent to revenue. And you know why we did what we did. It was because we didn't want a probability threshold for collectability in the model. And the trade-off with that was giving greater transparency as to, you know, potential impairments. And so we gave it this greater visibility in this line adjacent to revenue. And I think we acknowledged at the time that it would have been good if perhaps you could have separated the initial impairment from the, which isn't really truly an impairment, but from the subsequent impairment. But we just reasoned that that would not be practical to do, and therefore we put all together in this line adjacent to revenue. In my own mind, everything that I've heard since has suggested that perhaps what we should be doing is giving greater transparency to potential impairments, but not in a line adjacent to revenue, but try and deal with the problematic transactions, which I think are a relatively small population, which are those transactions which don't have a significant financing component in there. Because if you have got significant financing components in there, you've already discounted the revenue, and so you've reflected credit risk in the measurement of the revenue. So you haven't got a significant financing component. It is a bona fide transaction. So in other words, you got through step one of the model that strips out sort of deficient transactions. And so that leaves you with this sort of small population of transactions where you've advanced goods and services to the customer, but there is a significant credit risk there. And I suspect that that is largely when there's no incremental cost to you of entering into that transaction. Otherwise, why would you have entered into that transaction? And so I quite like your idea in here of perhaps doing something when there's a significant credit risk on those type of transactions and building that into the revenue piece, but only for those transactions and only for day one impairment. But that's just my personal view on what I've heard from the board discussion, from the user, and thinking about what you had in this paper. And I don't know whether Steve, you articulated something in the board meeting, and that's not probably a million miles apart from what you said, is it?
Yeah. I agree with everything you've just said. And I think that's what we should do, and hopefully we'll have that recommendation at the next meeting. I came up with something almost exactly what you have, but with the small modification of what Alison and Henry are just saying about the circumstances where there is a significant financing component. I agree with Henry that if there is high credit risk, that is already reflected in the discounted value of those future amounts. So it's already there. So putting an extra line item next to revenue is going to double count it. So I don't think that should be done.
That should not be an obstacle, we know.
No, that's true. So I think that the cleanest way of doing this is, as you exactly say, in the vast majority of cases, we keep the accounting as it is at the moment, and we just have the bad debts down as other expenses, and we drive on. But in those circumstances where there is a high degree of credit risk, we should give that greater prominence and put it next to revenue. And I agree with your analysis that there shouldn't be a collectability threshold, because that just goes completely contrary to the model that we're developing. So with the small modification that Henry and Alison suggested, I would agree.
I think that probability hurdle would be a very blunt tool to attack what I think is quite a narrow problem. When once you've analysed it down, I think it personally. I was very pleased to see what you said about the probability hurdle, but I do think it would be a very blunt tool. And what I said at the board meeting, and I still believe this, is that I think it would result in us effectively having almost like a dual revenue recognition model, in the sense that depending on whether or not you had got through that probability hurdle, revenue will be something different in both of those cases. In one case, it will reflect your entitlement to something because you transferred goods and services. In the other case, it will likely just reflect the cash as you receive it. And so that's, so you've got two very different metrics for revenue, depending on whether or not you've met the probability hurdle.
Yes, Doug.
In that case, do you put the subtotal, and will you call it the revenue, or in that case, will you call it the entitlement only revenue and just leave it as it is?
Without having thought about that a great deal, Tack, personally, I would say it is just part of revenue. I might provide some footnote information about it, but I see it as the same as when you have a significant financing component. What you've done is you've had to come up with the revenue amount, so you've discounted the cash flows to come up with the revenue. And we say that is the revenue because effectively it's almost like the cash equivalent price for those goods and services on that day. I think if I was to make this adjustment because there is significant credit risk in the transaction, I would just see that as being an adjustment to get at the revenue. So, and in other words, it's an adjustment to the consideration to get to the revenue amount. Similarly, as what I did when there was time value of money.
Just as a off the cuff thought, I wonder whether, in circumstances where there's high degree of credit risk, we don't mandate the discounting even if it's less than 1 year. Because then that automatically gets the credit in there. And if there is high degree of credit risk, the time value of money is much, much more significant than in these other circumstances. So maybe we just remove the practical expedient of the 12 months in those circumstances. I don't know. You think about it.
Well, except that there was quite a lot of concern about people, if you like, flipping between doing the discounting and not discounting at the last meeting. Some board members were quite concerned about that. But maybe that pressure's taken off if you're presenting all of the impairments in a similar way. But I see what you're saying, but I think we'd have to think about that.
You're stuck. No, don't.
Then I'm a bit confused with the distinction between day one loss and day two loss. And in the expected recommendation in November, we just put day one loss only, you said. You're not going to put the day two loss.
No.
Right.
Well, that's my... Yeah, talk in terms of expected, that's just my personal view at this moment. Yeah.
So in that case, what is the consistency between the case of revenue with a significant financial component? In the case of significant financial component, you will discount it.
Yeah.
And then what happens to the subsequent change of discount rate?
That was the thing under the ED, the impairment on the loan would get accounted for identically to any impairment on any other loan. Right. So that didn't go in the adjacent to revenue line.
Right. So in this
and that was one of the things that people didn't like about how impairments of loans got reported one way, but impairment of trade receivables, in other words, the day two adjustments got reported in a different way.
Right. So then that makes a consistency. Right. Okay.
Arguably, yes.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
I think this issue should be solved as a very narrow scope issue. Not Korea and China totally disagree with adjacent disclosure because they see the regular sales. So they don't focus a very narrow case. I think this is a similar thing like impairments, purchased credit impaired financial asset. In that case, your cost is so low. But this case, you add risk on the sales price. So you take out that risk from the sales price, that amount should be the revenue amount. That's what I think.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that's why, to tax question, I would make an adjustment to revenue in that type of situation, yeah.
Okay. That's all.
That Henry, you said adjusted to sales, is that introducing a recognition threshold, or it is different?
You mean how would you define when you do it?
Yeah, that's right.
That's the challenge.
Oh, that.
And, you know, and I can see some people saying it's really not possible to do that in a way that you'll enforce consistent behavior. So therefore, they might say retain the adjacent to revenue presentation because you don't have to deal with that problem. So that would be the challenge about sort of saying at what level would it be such that you would be making that adjustment, yeah.
Because in our paper, like it is explained in paragraph 26, our staff's view is, introducing revenue recognition threshold. Our staff do not agree with this because of the fundamentally inconsistent with the control notion proposed in the 2011 ED. And then it is a very strange example you showed at the various meeting, very extreme, with 10 customers.
Yeah.
Out of 10, 4 are good customers, and 6 are bad customers. By using this example, if you have a recognition threshold, no revenue in the first year, only a cost of sales for the good customer, so that the entire amount of cost of sales for the good customer becomes losses for that one first period. Then all of a sudden next year, collected amount from the four customers will become revenue, the no cost of sales. So total revenue collected by cash will become a profit for that year. very strange, you know. It is somehow against the instituted, so that if in your mind that threshold is defined like this, or maybe something wrong with this extreme case of example. In our paper says revenue top line should be, well, as defined under the tentative decision, that should be a contract amount or entitlement amount. And then, so that the gross amount should be shown as sales revenue, and then cost of sales and the impairment losses should be shown separately. So if we take that, you know, in the first year, only profit for the four good customers will be shown, and nothing in the second year. And then according to this example, you are taking as if like a cash basis accounting, you know.
I think you pointed it out here in your paper somewhere. I won't be able to find the paragraph, but applying that threshold, if we did decide to apply a threshold, there are many things to think about. What is that threshold, and how is it applied? What is your unit of account? And I think we made some assumptions in that example to just try to demonstrate what could happen, and I think we were just really assessing it on the customers as a whole to demonstrate that that may give you a strange result, particularly in light of our core principle to recognize revenue when control transfers. And you've picked up on it well, so perhaps it did its job, but that was what we were trying to demonstrate there.
I think it was a very sort of simplistic, extreme example, but I think it was just trying to show that if you recognize revenue and you recognize any consequential impairment, you get more transparency, you get more information about what's going on compared to saying, don't recognize any of the revenue and wait until the cash comes in. So, you know, that's how we sold the proposals in the 2011 ED. And in terms of, you know, whether or not you have a probability recognition hurdle, I still think that's a very valid point personally. And users generally seem to agree. Mm-hmm.
Shall we move to the
We have our revenue team members here sitting here.
Okay. Tokyo, you can speak.
They are sleeping.
Do you hear us? I think they hear us.
They are not rather confused.
I hope they're not sitting there.
Let's move on to topic three. Yeah. It's a constraint.
Well, I thought you wanted to let them speak, but no, okay, sorry.
Sorry. Let's move on to topic three. The constraint on the cumulative revenue amount recognized in a variable consideration. This topic was discussed by the boards in September but did not reach to an agreement. So, we would like to explain SBJ staff view on this topic before re-deliberation in the coming month. Paragraph 81 of the 2011 ED proposed to constrain the cumulative revenue amount to recognize up to the amount the entity is reasonably assured. The entity is reasonably assured if the entity has experience with a similar type of performance obligation, and that experience or other evidence must be predictive. And issue one, which of the three options is the most appropriate to improve the proposals in the 2011 ED to clarify if the entity's experience or other evidence is predictive? There are three options. The first option, to retain the 2011 ED qualitative assessment. Option two, to provide a determinative approach, or option three, to provide confidence threshold. Among three options, SBJ staff support the option three, mainly because the other two options do not address the concerns raised by the constituent to the 2011 ED. If we support the option three, then the next question is, what level of confidence do we need? And the SVJ staff believes highly confident threshold could be proposed as long as it is referred by user of financial statements. It's no conceptual reasons, but still we support option three and higher confidence level. So we'd like to further understand your views on constraint on cumulative revenue amount recognized in a value of consideration.
Gary.
Thanks, Kinnicka. I think, yeah, you're right. The three options that you've outlined in this paper were obviously the ones that we presented to the board in September. And I think, as you rightfully summarized, in an attempt to provide the board with options to address feedback that we'd received from users and certain regulators. I think the important thing here is that after we published that paper, it was made public, we received quite a lot of feedback from preparers who were concerned that moving anywhere away from the 2011 ED with that indicator approach would restrict their revenue recognition, specifically in the construction industries where current US GAAP and IFRS doesn't even allow them, it expects that they would use a level of estimation to calculate their revenue recognition. And I think that some of that, there's a bit of a difficulty between reconciling how certain industries currently recognize revenue where judgments or estimates are readily accepted by the market and users, whereas in other industries maybe that it's a bit more restrictive when you aren't in that construction industry accounting. So I think, you know, we didn't ask the boards to make a decision at that September meeting, but I think based off some of the board discussions and the feedback we got, you'll probably not be happy to know that I think moving forward, we're probably going to move away from option three as an alternative forward for the boards when we possibly bring this back in November. And I think some of the reasoning around that was that, well, the first one, as I said, was that there was a lot of concern from preparers that this would significantly change their revenue recognition profiles when their users, apparently they say, are happy with the way that they're recording revenue today. I think some of the other reasons why we possibly are going to move away from option three was, as you pointed out in the paper, we used a term like highly confident or confident, and one of the disadvantages we pointed out in the paper was to say the boards would then need to quantify or clarify what we meant by highly confident. Otherwise, all we'd really done was replace the words reasonably assured with highly confident. You know, so unless we provided a more quantitative number that we were aiming for, it wouldn't really have solved the issue. And I think the problem with proposing that quantitative number would have been that it would have been arbitrary. So, you know, the boards would have effectively been making a call and assume that we had gone option three and we decide that 87% is the right number. If one entity, based on its past practice, demonstrates that it hits its revenue target or the variable target 85% of the time, they would not be allowed to recognize revenue on that type of transaction, whereas another entity, let's say, can show that they're 88% confident that they would hit the target, they would record revenue. So you would get vastly different revenue recognition profiles depending on what side of the line you fell on. And it wasn't really necessarily conceptual. I think we're trying to move away from bright line numbers. So I think some of that was in the paper, but I think that the latest thinking is we're probably going to try and move away from that. And I think the problem that we have is that we're trying to, and I think the way that we're going to try and find a solution is focusing more on what are those paragraphs in the revenue standard trying to get at. So clarifying more what the objective is behind paragraphs 81 to 84, and not necessarily the focus on how we get there. So I think the whole thing is that there was this, you know, as we've gone along with this, there seems to be a bit of confusion by preparers in terms of whether or not the current wording means that you just need to be able to make a good estimate. In other words, you can make a predictive estimate, or whether or not that you have to be able to make a predictive estimate, and then you need to test that estimate to see how variable it is or how volatile the number that you're going to try and recognize is. And I think it's what we're going to try and do is maybe clarify that we're really trying to get to, you need to be able to make a quality estimate, and then you need to be able to test that estimate's variance around whether or not there's going to be a significant reversal, because that's, as you pointed out and what we had in our paper, what where users' concern is. And I think if we can clarify exactly what we're trying to do, then I think it becomes less important in the way that an entity actually does it. So the if we're more clear on what we're trying to achieve, then whether or not we go with indicators, as in the 2011 EDL, we try and be more prescriptive and say you need to do some form of calculation, I think that becomes less of an issue, which I think is the way that we're going to try and reconcile the views, because, as you pointed out, there's concern by users and maybe some regulators in terms of the robustness of the model. But at the same time, on the other side, we've got preparers, some users as well, and the auditors as well, who really didn't have an issue with the 2011 ED. So it's the challenge for us when we bring the paper back is trying to reconcile all those views in a way that's, that makes the model more workable.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions, remarks? No? Okay, then we've come to the conclusion of our open session, public session. We'll take a break till 3:15.